I want to welcome everybody here to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon, where we have one case on the oral argument docket. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that you have here today. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right, Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand from the clerk that that counsel have all checked in, and so without further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. All right, you may proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to apologize to the court in advance. If I'm coughing, I assure you I'm not ill. I just have the residual cough from a cold that hasn't left me yet. May it please the court. I'm pleased to be here to represent Kathy Jones Hospod and Judy Jones. And the first thing I would like to draw the court's attention to, there's a recent case that came down on May the 5th that I think is going to be a case that, of importance. It deals with the law of the case. It's Estate of Tillotson out of the 6th District, Texarkana. It's reporters beside it this time. It's 2022. TexApp Lexus 2994. While our case is a guardianship, the Tillotson case is administration of an estate, but as this court is aware, the statutory schemes are similar between guardianship and estates. We have a dearth of case law relative to how the business of the statutory bill of review interacts with the business of an appeal, which was previous in this case. The Tillotson case had two trips to the Dallas Court of Appeals, and so you can begin to see the significance of it. They found, and one of the other differences that is significant is the fact that in the Tillotson case, there was a bill of review that was heard and denied, where in our case, what we have is we have the court granting the dismissal and then sua sponte saying, if I were to hear it, I would not, I would deny it. And we set out the reasoning of the court in our brief. But so we did, Ms. Jones-Hospod and Ms. Jones did not receive any ability to present their case on their bill of review. But we did meet the pleading standard. And the case law shows that the pleading standard does not have to be proved in the pleadings. That can be done at trial. So, but what the Court of Appeals in Texarkana did was they applied law of the case relative to the overlap of the bill of review complaining about matters that had already been up before the Court of Appeals. There are a couple of things that were interesting that, and what happened was they said that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting, denying the bill of review because they did not prove adequately the substantive error that goes with the proof that has to be made.
Did that case involve anything about whether someone had standing or was an interested party, interested person?
No. There's so many questions that are not part of it, but and it does not also involve the interesting conflict we have here with Jones Hospod having done an appeal and her sister Judy Jones not having done an appeal and how that works. So there's none of that. But the court said the doctrine of law of the case is based on public policy. And we would note for the court that if it's public policy, that's insufficient to override the statutory nature of the bill of the statutory bill of review. That, in other words, the statutory bill of review should be, in our opinion, treated differently than an equitable bill of review as far as finality, and it, that it stands on its own. We don't think we've had sufficient appellate case law to guide us yet in, and I'm on the Supreme Court. We have a little bit at the lower level, but the Supreme Court has really not answered the questions. That's why we call them primarily their questions of first impression that have come up in this matter. One of the other things they say is that a party cannot try his action in pieces. Well, that's fine for all the rest of the law except for probate and guardianship, because that's what we do every day. We try the cases in pieces. So then another thing that the Tillotson case said that is interesting and not in line with some of the others, when an appellate court, as this court has in the previous 2016, affirms a trial court's judgment or renders a judgment which the trial court should have rendered, the judgment becomes the judgment of both courts. And they cite Cook versus Cameron, a Texas 1987 case. Now, what I think is interesting about that is a lot of what I've seen on the law of the case, the res judicata argument, et cetera, really is the idea that it became the Court of Appeals order, not the Court of Appeals and the trial court's order. So I think that's an interesting distinction that this case throws out. There are an awful lot of issues with the in this appeal. Is there any area that the court, I mean?
Well, I have a question. Have either Kathy or Judy ever posted security for costs as the probate court required?
No, they have not.
Then why can they bring this action since the prior order that you appealed from, the August the 10th, 2015 order that was a part of the earlier appeal to this court, said that Kathy Jones and Judy Jones may not be heard with regard to this guardianship case as to any application, complaint, or opposition of any kind. Isn't that exactly what you're doing in this bill of review proceeding, filing an application, complaint, or opposition? So why can they proceed without posting security for cost?
Well, that's part of the bill of review. I mean, we were not the counsel, and the bill of review is hard to follow. The statutory bill of review, we decided when we looked at that it had merit, or we would have only appealed the sanctions portion of it. But basically, it's our position that that those orders and all those April the 10th, April the 15th orders are not binding.
But that's even though this court in the prior opinion already affirmed this exact same order on appeal, you think you don't have to follow it?
No, that's, let me explain myself better, okay? What we say is that the statutory scheme of guardianship, same as administration in estates, gives the, specifically provides a second opportunity that is not barred by, and that's why this law of the case becomes so important in terms of if it's a matter, and this is what we're missing. We're missing a hearing, which in our opinion we were entitled to, where the court would have said, much like Tillotson, we decided this on these other two appeals, okay? We haven't decided this. We decided this other thing, and so that it's a matter of, because what the court just said was, this is res judicata, if you look at the statutory bill of review, it is not, it has some overlap, but actually very little overlap. Part of what else has to be decided is, and how one would approach this and how one would decide, is how did the appellate courts look at the previous order, the previous opinion that was rendered in the prior case in this, and decide how broad it is, how narrow it is. Is it just some blanket? You can never have these matters brought up, even under the statutory bill of review. All of these questions of law that don't have a decision, or in other words, appellate opinion, to give us any guidance on. And but that would, in other words, we have issues that are undecided. Both the Jones ladies were interested parties as of the time of the April the 10th, as of the time of the April 15th orders. That gives them standing under the statutory bill of review language.
But then they were determined not to be interested parties anymore because they were disqualified, and we upheld that, at least as to one of the Ms. Joneses, and the other one didn't appeal, and nobody took it to the Supreme Court after our decision came out in 2016. So I know that statutory bills of review and all that kind of stuff is complicated, but I'm having trouble getting past the simple notion that we've already ruled that or affirmed that these people have no interest in this case anymore and are disqualified, and so I don't know how many bites at the apple parties are supposed to get.
Well, part of the complexities in this specific case is the fact that Judy didn't appeal, and so how did she wind up?
Right, so then wouldn't the trial court opinion have become final as to her if she chose not to appeal it?
Well, that in my opinion, this is where we get into some really interesting questions of law, which is, and when you talk, okay, that it's been decided, but did that wipe out the statutory from it as being a remedy because there's been an appeal? In other words, we look at the typical standard appeal, trial court loses jurisdiction after 105 days, but that's not what happens in probate and guardianship court. The trial court maintains its jurisdiction over the case and over the orders it's entered for two entire years to review them. It's not just necessarily to do away with them, to make changes, to make corrections. It's much broader than just the appeal aspect of it, because of course it can be a direct attack on the prior orders that starts out in the trial court rather than in the appellate court. So what happened, and it's, I think this is the issue that the court is addressing, if at the end of the first appeal on those matters, then was the trial court forbidden to ever revisit that? There's no statute that says that. There's nothing that wipes it out. And doesn't statute override public policy when it's specifically, in terms of what we're talking about, law of the case, what's been decided, res judicata? And so when they're arguing things like, well, we want finality, but the statutory code doesn't provide for that. It's a completely different, unique aspect of the law. And what's happening is we keep, the courts, when they have addressed it, very rarely, have brought it back to the law that is very different, which we all know how that works. And I would agree with the justice that if it would not a probate or a guardianship matter, absolutely, we would, you know, it, there wouldn't be, other than an equitable bill of review, which is a different, really a different animal, because the equitable bill of review has really different purposes than the broad ability to be flexible that the statutory scheme in probate and guardianship provides for.
So the ward, she's what, 85 now? 84, 85?
She's quite elderly, and she's not in good health. And
are her assets being depleted over this fight? I'm just curious.
Well, to the extent that her interests are represented by opposing counsel, they are not depleted from the perspective of the large amount of money that the other two daughters of the four have invested. I mean, one of the real tragedies of this case is that the Judy Jones and Kathy Hospod Jones are basically precluded from a typical normal mother-daughter relationship. And I mean, that's partly why they can't let go of it. And understandably so. You know, the parent-child relationship, and we have some reference to just how significant that is. And part of the problem is that the motions in limine, the disqualification, don't provide the level of due process, and this is in the Bill of Review, this is partly why we decided it had merit, that permit the disqualification, that permit the motion in limine, in the, such that they basically have their parent-child relationship terminated. Because that's a, both ways, that's a parent-child and a child-parent.
Have the parties ever mediated to try to work out some sort of visitation schedule?
I think that would be wonderful. Right now, you know, we were in a position that we're not permitted to participate except in these appellate.
But you could voluntarily work something out. The parties could.
We'd be delighted to participate in something like that. But as I say, I mean, it's we have this brick wall in front of us.
Thank you. Ms. Wolfram.
May it please the court, counsel. I will be speaking on behalf of Ellen Smith, the guardian, as well as her sister, Patty Peacock, who has joined as a party, although, and she has been included in this for the purposes of just trying to clear the record, hopefully, and get her out of this, but she was joined in the amended bill of review and served in this case, so she is a party, and then I will be speaking also as on both sides of for the appellees, which would be Ms. Virginia Hammerly, who is the guardian ad litem for the board, May K. Jones. Your Honors, as you know, this appeal is the second round of the third appeal in this case. This case has been going on since 2014. I've been involved since the beginning. And back in 2015, both of the appellants were found to be disqualified and unsuitable under Chapter 1104, which specifically would be 1104.351 and .352 of the Estates Code, and they were also found to be disqualified under 1055.001B, which is, as the court is aware, the adverse interest and the standing component that says you don't get to, you know, if you're found to be adverse to the board's interests, then you don't have standing, which is a jurisdictional matter. This original judgment with respect to the appointment of my client, Ellen Smith, as the permanent guardian, as well as affirmance of the order in limine, the order striking the pleadings for failure to post bond, all of those were upheld by this court in 2016 in an appeal brought solely by Kathy Jones. Judy Jones, for whatever reason, chose not to appeal, and she became bound by the trial court's judgments and orders. They have come before this court now under only a statutory bill of review, not an equitable one, and that statutory bill of review is found at Texas Estates Code 1056.101. And this review is therefore limited to what is in that statute. And what is in that statute, Your Honors, is that the first provision in 1056.101 is that you have to be an interested person. And they are no longer interested persons. And this is an interesting case because they have somebody who chose to appeal, somebody who didn't choose to appeal, and now they're coming at it from both directions. And, well, we get it one way or another. We're aligned parties. We had same counsel for the most part. We filed joint pleadings. We filed a joint contest to the original application for guardianship. We filed counter applications for appointment to be the guardian of the estate and the guardian of the person. All that was done the same pleadings, but yet we get to bifurcate, we get to make different arguments, we get to have more than one bite at the apple because either we get it because of the appellate process or we get it because of not appealing. And so that's kind of been the way that this has been run. But as the court is well aware, when you're looking at a statutory bill of review, you have to look at the statute. It's not the same thing as an equitable bill of review. The courts are limited by what the legislature has to say. The legislature didn't have to provide this bill of review process, so it is what it is. And as it turns out, it was very wise on behalf of the Texas legislature to say only an interested person can bring a statutory bill of review. Well, where is that? Why is that wise? Well, for one thing, if they did not have that limitation, then it would turn on its ear the statute 1055-001B that says if you don't have standing because you have an interest adverse to the ward, then you don't get to contest the application. You don't get to file your own application. You no longer have standing to modify. You don't have standing to restore the ward's rights. You've lost out on all those things because you have been found liable for unsuitable and adverse behaviors that show that you do not act in the interest and the well-being of the ward.
So if I understand your position, it's like, let's say somebody has been found adverse, disqualified, whatever, therefore they are not an interested person. Their only remedy from that original finding is a direct appeal. And if they lose on the direct appeal, you're saying they can't come back and use a statutory bill of review to say, well, maybe we are an interested person, and the trial court was wrong about that.
I think that is exactly correct, Your Honor. And that is the way the statute is written. And so the legislature chose who could have a statutory bill of review and who couldn't have a statutory bill of review. And so it's not like they didn't have a remedy. Kathy Jones actually chose her remedy, and that was to go up on a direct appeal. She was not successful on that direct appeal. Judy Jones, for whatever reason, chose to accept the judgment of the court, which made final for her disqualification, unsuitability, and adverse position to the ward. So it made final her uninterested status. So she chose her remedy, which was to let things lie the way that they were. But either way, whether it's by direct appeal that you lose or whether you don't appeal at all, you are now no longer an interested party under the statute. And it has to be that way because otherwise the motions in limines don't mean anything. If what has happened in this particular case could happen, sadly, in many other cases. If you have somebody who has been found to be not an interested person under a motion in limine, if that person can thereafter file a bill of review, then what was the purpose of the motion in limine? You've just effectively written it out of the statute, out of the code, and that can't be what the legislature meant. So you cannot come to the conclusion that the appellants are asking you to come to without doing violence to the motion in limine statute. So also wanted to briefly address the issue of whether or not the bill of review was entitled to be had because there was an allegation that the trial court's orders are void as opposed to voidable, and I think that is an issue that has to be addressed. And I think it can be addressed and was appropriately addressed through the motion to dismiss process because on the face of the, I'm only gonna address the amended bill of review because that was the live pleading. On the face of the amended bill of review, they pleaded themselves out of this argument. There was a prayer at the end of the amended pleading that said, find that these orders are void. But then they set out all the ways in which the bill of review should be granted and had nothing to do with whether or not the orders were void. What they were arguing was that the order should be avoided, not that they were void. And that's a very, very, very big difference. Based on their own pleadings and based on the court record, and the court did take judicial notice of its entire record for purposes of these hearings that were had, the probate court had jurisdiction of the person and jurisdiction of the subject matter. This is a statutory probate court. And so there was clear jurisdiction of both Mae K. Jones, the parties involved, and subject matter of the case, which was guardianship over Mae K. Jones. There was some argument that there wasn't personal jurisdiction over either one or both of Kathy Jones or Judy Jones, but the record shows that Judy Jones was personally served a citation, as was Mae K. Jones, and Kathy Jones and Judy Jones both voluntarily appeared before the court. They filed a contest. They filed their own counter applications, and so they made a general appearance, and so any argument that there wasn't jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over them was waived by their general appearance.
I've got a question, again, on the security for cost. Do you believe that the trial court's earlier order requiring Kathy and Judy to post security for costs applied to the bill of review proceeding?
To be honest with you, I hadn't really thought of that before you asked it this afternoon, but I think the answer is yes. It makes imminent sense.
Then my question is, why didn't you file a motion to strike like you did in the other proceeding?
Progressive revelation. Honestly, because Your Honor this afternoon raised that point. It hadn't occurred to me before. I think it is a valid point that would apply to this, but it wasn't done.
Well, do you agree that Kathy and Judy have not posted security for cost?
That is accurate.
Okay, have they paid the sanctions that were ordered in their recusal order?
No, they have not. No sanctions have been paid at all. No security for cost was ever paid or filed at all. So all of the basis for avoidance versus voidness in the amended application for the bill of review are all based upon errors in the trial court's rulings and opinions and orders, as opposed to whether or not there was actual jurisdiction for the court to enter those orders. So the mere allegation that an order is void should not force a trial court to hold a bill of review hearing or trial just based solely on that allegation, especially when the rest of the pleading itself clearly shows that it is a matter of seeking avoidance of the orders as opposed to whether or not they're actually void. I also want to just briefly address the continuance argument that was raised by appellants in their brief. The appellants voluntarily fired their attorney a few short days before the hearing. That's found in the clerk's record at 907 and 908. They voluntarily withdrew their bill of review from hearing. That's found in the clerk's record at page 909. So there's an argument in the brief, on the appellant's brief at page 50 on the brief, that somehow the court unlawfully refused to give them a hearing on their bill of review. That's not accurate. They unilaterally withdrew their bill of review from hearing. And then the guardian ad litem, Ms. Hammerly, and I, on behalf of my client, Ellen Smith, did not withdraw our motions to dismiss and my motion for sanctions from hearing. So what we went to hearing on in April of 2019 were the three motions to dismiss, two filed by Ms. Hammerly, one filed by me on behalf of my client, and then my motion for sanctions. And there was no trial on the bill of review because they unilaterally withdrew it. So when my place to say they couldn't do that. I think they had every right to do that. And then they sought an ex parte continuance, and then the court heard their continuance at the hearing before the motions to dismiss, and she denied it. The absence of counsel was their decision, because they fired their lawyer. And so their lack of counsel was their own decision. And the timing of the firing of their counsel was their own decision. So a continuance for lack of counsel, they didn't meet the threshold requirements, one of which is it has to be due to no fault of their own. And so, yes, their lawyer filed a motion to withdraw, which was uncontested by them, but they had already fired her. So their lack of counsel was totally on them. With respect to the sanctions, there is case law, and that's cited in the brief, that res judicata can be the basis for a Rule 13 violation. And there is clearly res judicata in this case. There's clearly law of the case in this instance, based on this court's prior opinion affirming the trial court's judgments that were being sought to be reviewed in the bill of review. And there was a lot of evidence presented in support of the motion for sanctions. Judy and Kathy Jones both testified at the hearing. And then there were numerous exhibits that were entered into, and then there was multiple testimony with respect to the incurrence of legal fees and costs with respect to the Rule 13. The court was entitled to take evidence on the motives and the credibility of the witnesses and the motives and credibility of the persons who filed the pleadings. And as the court is well aware, a 13 can extend not only to counsel but also to the parties. And so the court made detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law with respect to not only the motions to dismiss but also with respect to the sanctions orders. And that by and large has not been briefed by the appellants in their appeal. So we have argued that those points have been waived by the appellants and that those sanctions orders should be upheld. The case that we cited in our brief with respect to law of the case based on the Court of Appeals opinion is the Smalley against Smalley case. And I briefly saw and did not have time to read all of the opinion of the Tillotson case. Counsel was kind enough to let me take a peek at her copy of the that case. I had not seen it before, so I was grateful to her for that. I did not get through all of it, but it seems to, what I could read of it, it seems to support the Smalley against Smalley opinion and that the denial of the bill of review was justified. To the extent that counsel was making an argument that there is some material difference between coming to the same conclusion as what we're advocating for in this case, and the only difference being whether or not you get a hearing on your bill of review or you don't, that to me seems to be the doing of a useless act. You don't get to backdoor saying I get a hearing on my bill of review so you can kick me out, but you can't kick me out without a hearing on a bill of review, even though my pleadings don't set up the right to a bill of review, even though there's res judicata, even though there's law of the case. And this court's prior opinion is law of the case, and it has to be law of the case for everyone. And why is that so? Because there's only one ward, there's only one guardianship case, and you can't split the case. And the fact that there were issues not argued in the first appeal, that's exactly what transactional res judicata is all about in the state of Texas. You need to bring forward everything that you want to bring forward, or you lose those issues for failure to brief them and failure to argue them and bring them before the court system. and res judicata reaches all of that. And basically, part of what they're arguing in their bill of review is that, well, anything that we held back in the first appeal, we get to now argue in the bill of review, and it doesn't count. We get a second bite at the apple because we didn't argue it. Well, that's not the law in Texas. Res judicata reaches every one of those issues. And this court's opinion is law of the case. It has to be, because otherwise you just have serial motions for bills of review and additional challenges. And by people in this particular instance who have already been disqualified. And this is an important case, and I appreciate having the opportunity to argue this case before the court. And this case really is kind of a quintessential example of why the statutory bill of review does not include people who have been kicked out as not interested persons.
I've got a quick question. Yes. Before your time is up. On your motion to dismiss, no place in the motion of yours are the ad litem's motion doesn't mention 91A, but you mention it in your brief. Do you believe that your motions to dismiss qualify as motions under 91A?
I do, Your Honor. It doesn't specific. It technically, did it follow all the rules of 91A? No. Did it follow the substance and the intent of 91? Yes. Was there an objection made to it? No. And would that be a waiver? I believe that would be a waiver, Your Honor. And I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Reply, Ms. Crampton.
May I please court? Probably the biggest response that I want to make is this idea that back in April of 2019, when those orders are entered, that did away with a statutory bill of review for whomever it affected. In other words, in the statutory scheme, there is no support for that, and I've cited case law in my brief that says, no, the test where you go to look is, was there standing at the time those orders were entered? Were they participants? If so, there's an interested party for purposes of a statutory bill of review. This is not a matter that if you get lemonied out or disqualified, that the only thing you have for complaining about those orders that do that is a direct appeal. You won't find anything and a lot of the opposing counsel's argument is dependent on the idea that, well, we really don't need to get any further than this because all you have to do is say they lost their standing when the orders were entered. And if you'll take a look at the case law, you'll see that's not the test. And it doesn't make logical sense that there's nothing in the statute that would support that you somehow, because you were lemonied out, all you have is direct appeal. The bite at the apple is statutory, the second bite. This isn't something that we made up, and there's not been a load of case law. I mean, the courts are going to be swamped. The history of statutory bills of review doesn't support that there has been that kind of a attempt to go up on appeal and have a statutory review be then somehow done away with because you had an appeal. In fact, what it is, it's intended to give. Let's say, for example, that what happened here was that the guardian and Miss Peacock were killed in a terrible accident. And the court then had to review, for example, what is the situation? And there's evidence that this is a case where one or both of the two appellants in this matter might be. Do you see? In other words, there's so much flexibility of the court to relook at the area, and so to hold that that it goes away, the statutory bail of review, because there's been a direct appeal, it's not supported. And the test is not void. That's a rabbit trail. The test is substantial error. And that's what we have to, and so as far as what the bill of review is, sanctions on appeal, lots of case law that can be reserved, which it has been, does not have to be paid. A continuance, these ladies discovered, as you see in the facts that are really irrelevant to this appeal, but as far as their lawyers go, that Ms. Swager was threatening the court, was threatening these ladies. I don't know, but what do you do with those kind of acts being attributed to you? You fire that lawyer. And you have to take what was happening here into the context of how frightened the Jones women were about discovering that their lawyer was off the track, and she was. And she has not appealed this, and we think the sanctions very much stand against her. But they're Rule 13 sanctions. Our clients never signed anything. Candace Swager hasn't appealed anything about this, but as regards to the Jones women, they took appropriate action to try, and then they were entitled constitutionally to a matter of having additional time because of the circumstances that they found themselves in, of which the court was well aware. I believe that opposing counsel ceded that 91A was not something that I need to worry about or do supplemental ask for ability to address that, because that's certainly not anything I would like to point out one other thing that's unusual, and that is the fact that the appellee's brief is not signed, and somehow it got through the clerk's office. That probably needs to be corrected.
Thank you very much. All right, we appreciate y'all being here this afternoon and presenting oral argument for us. It's been quite helpful. And with that, we will stand in recess.